And welcome back to Good Morning Siouxland, KSCJ Radio. Brian Vakulskas with you and in the studio with me. Well, before we get to that, it's school season. School's back in session, which also means that Lam Arts Limited is back in session. And they are premiering, at least locally here, the new production by Sean Grennan. It is called Now and Then, and it is a fantastic production. And what's really special about this time of year in Sioux City is that the playwright, Sean Grennan, is actually here. He's in the studio with me this morning. He's a New York City-based playwright. Grennan's in Sioux City, had a chance to see the play last weekend. But before we get going into the plot of the play, I know that you talked about a word, enowment, that came to you when you came up with the idea for this play. What's that? How did that word come to you when it's meaning and then translating it into making a play?
Okay, sure. I think it might be in Newman. It's a brand new word. It's like one of those new age words that has just appeared and we prefer to scoff at because it's new and, you know, that's new. But it's enowment, E-N-O-U-E-M-E-N-T. And I was reading something, and I have a habit now when I come across a word I don't know, I love words. I looked it up. I found something. It's in about three dictionaries, but not all of them. But it basically means wistful sadness at not being able to tell your younger self what you know now. And I think that's a feeling that is fairly universal, and it kind of just went into me like a knife when I read that, and I sat there just thinking about it, and my wife came into the room and she said, what's going on with you? She knows my faces, you know. She said, what are you doing? I said, I think I'm writing a new play. And I wrote a whole play based on that idea.
From one word. But yeah. The play is a comedy, drama, as really all of yours are. But it's mostly a love story.
It is. I guess you could say it's a love story. It's got comedy and drama in it. I don't try to like keep anything out. I think life is all of that. Even tragic things have funny things in them, and funny things have sad things in them, and I think that's life's a big mess that way, and I try to reflect that. Yeah.
Well, there's four characters. Jamie and Abby are a couple, and Jamie's a bartender. I'm not telling you anything you don't know, right? you created these people.
I kind of know them a little bit.
But there's this unique hook about how the older gentleman gets into the play. Can you kind of explain that?
Yeah, by the way, I don't want to give away too much because it has a mystery quality about it.
Right.
But basically, the play begins, takes place in 1985. Jamie is a bartender. He's closing up the bar. The place is empty. And he's closing up. It's the end of the night and everything. And this older gentleman comes in, and he just wants one drink. And even though it's only 20 minutes to go, he just wants one drink. And he talks Jamie into it. And they exchange, they chat like guys do in a bar and about things, and they get into some of the stuff that Jamie wants to do. And Jamie's girlfriend shows up, and they're just all chatting for a bit and messing around. And then there's a sense of urgency in the older gentleman, and he wants to stay even though they have to close the bar. And he offers them, it's so desperate that he offers them each $200 if he could just sit there. Then they turn him down. And then he heads for the door, and he turns and he offers them each $1,000 if he could just sit there and talk to them. And they agree. And he starts telling them a story. And that's how the play goes.
So you set it in a bar. It's really a closed universe setting.
It is.
And
absolutely.
So what are the advantages and then the limitations of using that for a set?
Yeah, it's, well, one of the advantages of having just one set is that theaters can afford to do it. They don't have to have a waterfall, and you know, they don't have to have a lot of things. It's called a closed room play. Basically, the limitations are, of course, the play's going to be very verbal. You're not going to have a lot of stuff in the play, especially when it's a bar. You can't just introduce a dinosaur. You know, you have to work in the reality of that world. But I felt like I had enough twists and turns in the plot and what they talk about that I would that it would keep people pulled along. If you can go to other places, if you can flashback to the past or something, or if you can go to another place where there's a gunfight, of course that adds some interest. But it isn't that kind of play. So it's I've written a few plays like this. I wrote a two-hander that takes place all in one room, two actors. It's tougher. Four is still kind of confining because there's only four people to talk. We have to have enough stuff going on that it keeps the audience interested. But it's fun. I think it works all right.
You've got experience working as a bartender.
I do.
At a bar with a great name, Fiddler's Green, in Chicago.
Yes, you know this. Yeah.
I research.
You do.
Russ has taught me well.
Okay, all right.
But tell me how you work in there for somebody who writes characters, that's got to be a perfect place to see characters.
Oh, it's great. It's great in a certain strange way. It is. You know, I don't necessarily think that's the only way you can learn to be a writer, but, you know, there are a lot of characters went through that bar. It was a 4 o'clock bar in Chicago. And I'm from Chicago originally. I live in New York now. But it's basically, most bars in Chicago are 2 o'clock. You have to close at 2. And then there's like a handful that are 4 o'clock. So they are the Wild West, because all the 2 o'clock bars, people pre-drunk, come into the 4 o'clock bars. And we would get a huge rush at 2 in the morning. And I had a bar that was, it was maybe a couple 1,500 square feet. And we had to have like 7 doormen, because people come in that loaded. They're all a little, you know, they're just a little crazy, you know. So and we get this huge rush, and many interesting and unusual and sad things happened. And I managed the bar for 4 years while I was trying to do theater on the side. It was great because I could, I made the schedule. So if I got a show as an actor, I would do the late shift. I would literally come to work at midnight and work till 4 in the morning. So I could still make some money, because the theater I was doing wasn't making many. But you learn a lot about people, especially when alcohol tends to strip away things and you see people more primally, if you will, or changes them. Some people turn into happy drunks, and some people turn into mean ones. So you learn a lot about human nature, you know. So
what makes it a 4 o'clock bar versus 2 o'clock? You've greased local politicians for the extra 2 hours. How's that work?
That's, you know, that was not my end of things, but but I think it's like that. They had a certain, it's like taxi cab licenses. You know, there's a certain amount of licenses out there, and they got one of them. So that's how it works.
You premiered Now and Then in Wisconsin there, and I know you've premiered several of your works there. Mm-hmm. What is it about when you select where you're going to do the premiere that makes you pick, I want a Wisconsin audience for this, I want the Wisconsin actors, or is it just particular that theater company?
That theater company was mostly it. I mean, Peninsula Players was the name of that theater, and they are largely a bunch of, it's all Chicago actors and directors who work up there, because that place is kind of a Chicago millionaire's playground. You know, they all have their wonderful mansions on the lake up there. So they have a lovely theater, and I had relationships with a lot of the actors and directors and stuff from when I worked and lived in Chicago all those years. Greg Winkler, who ran that place, came to see a reading of a play of mine called Making God Laugh in New York. When he happened to be in town, invited him. He came and he booked it, and it started us as a relationship going that way. It's an equity theater. It's about 650 seats. It's right on the water. It's a beautiful brand new space. They just built it, and they put a lot of money into their shows. And frankly, they have the facilities to bring me in, feed me, you know, give me housing and all that stuff, so I can be at rehearsals. Because the first show, you have to be there. You have to be at every rehearsal to fit it on the actors, like clothing. You have to, like, oh, that line's too long. Oh, that's not funny. Oh, this is good. How about try this speech instead? You know, so I go back to my room and type things out and bring it back. So it's a good situation.
Now, after it premieres at a theater like that, are you done as far as rewrites go, or can you think about something maybe a month later and go, oh, hell, I'm going to put this in the play?
Oh, yeah, it's an interesting question. It's one of the reasons this play I have not given to my publisher yet, because I've learned over the years that stuff occurs to you later, even if you had a successful run with the initial one. Like Tin Woman, it was a very successful opening, and I've had many productions, and then something occurred to me that people seemed to want from it. I wrote a couple little speeches for one of the characters that filled something out that was a little hole. It was fine, but it was a sort of a gap. Unfortunately, I had already given that one to my publisher, and they're very reticent to reprint once they print it. So I can't get that into the printed version anymore, and it's frustrating to me. So like when somebody books the show, I contact them and I send them the pages they need, you know, the supplemental stuff. But that's one reason I come here, and seeing their production, I've got some ideas for some changes, because I see what this is. Is this going on too long? Is this right? Is this funny enough? Is that, you know, that kind of thing. I'm still in the development part of my brain right now.
Do you find the audiences maybe in Sioux City, Iowa, find stuff funny that somebody in San Francisco or Pittsburgh or Wisconsin or wherever doesn't find funny?
You know, honestly, no. It's people are people. I really try to write for just humans, just regular folks. I don't tend to write issue plays. You know, I don't write about this big incident or that thing. I don't write about, issues. I write about people as much, As I've gone along, you know, I'm 63 now, and I've lived in a lot of different places now. I'm struck by how people are people. You know, so if they're stupid, they would may not get. I'm kidding. If they may not get something, but mostly everybody responds similarly, and that's great for me. You know,
could you have written this play as a 23-year-old, 33-year-old, or does it take somebody with some miles and years under your belt to kind of grasp the issues that come up in this play?
That's a great question. I don't think I could have. I was an English major in school, and I wrote, but I think this play and some of the others, my more recent stuff, I think you need some miles for it. There are certainly precocious writers out there who are tremendous at 22. I was barely dressing myself at 22, so it's it's not. I think I needed to be a little older to get this kind of thing done. Yeah.
Have you ever been to one of your plays where you see it performed and you have a nails on the chalkboard moment that there's no way this character is good for this role? Not for this now and then, but maybe for the Tin Woman or something like that. Or this shouldn't be staged that way.
I have, and it's like Tracy Letts, the playwright who wrote August Osage County. He famously said, "There's no greater torture than going to the second production of your show." Because you're not involved with that in any way, and you don't know the director. You might just be invited to a production, and you. Mostly, people respond to the stuff. I do go to other productions that I'm not involved in just to see how they're responding to what's on the page, because they're not going to be on the phone with me, and I'm not going to be there. So I'm curious. What I wrote, is it speaking clearly? And so I've gone to a few, and mostly I've been fine with it. I did go to one production of Tin Woman that. I just, wow. One of the characters went off in a direction. It was like everybody else was doing one play, and this character was doing Three's Company or something. I don't know what they were doing. It was like, you know, O'Neill, Three's Company, O'Neill. So it was kind of like upsetting. But I didn't say anything. You know, you want to be gracious when people are trying, you know. So.
But as the playwright, can you, you know, say that Joe Blow High School wants to do your play. They don't have the facilities, the directors, the actors to pull off a play like this. Do you have the veto power, or if they cough up the money and want the play, they're going to get it?
Once it's published, I mean, I could prevail upon the publisher not to. Interesting, like The Tin Woman, the previous show they did, is done by a lot of high schools. They do it in competitions a lot, and they do a cut version of it. They might do a half an hour version. They might take a scene out and stuff like that. At that level, I don't stop anybody, because I was in high school. You know, this is how you learn. It may be awful. And interestingly, since you mentioned that, I got contacted by my own high school about a month ago, and they are doing The Tin Woman next week. And they've sent me a plane ticket and asked me to come and talk to the kids and teach a couple classes. So I guess I can die now, because my high school is doing my play. You know, because that's the circle is closed and we're fine. But.
This is something I've always been curious about. When, you know, writers, you write, mm-hmm. and when I interview a novelist, the whole goal is to get published, to get it out there, and mm-hmm. sell copies. Mm-hmm. Playwrights don't work that way. How do you define the success of a play once it's written, commercial-wise? Is it when it's performed? Is it when the publishing company buys it? Where do you draw that line for a commercial success, other than personal success?
Yeah. I'm a guy and an American. I want to get my work out there and make some money from it and things like that. Those are guy things, you know, or human things. I love it when the show reaches people. Because what I do is kind of esoteric, and it's not a hard career. It's sort of in some ways a little soft career. But I love it when it reaches people, and people write me a note or something, or they say something. That feels very successful to me. If you get a play on Broadway or something that, you know, you make a lot of money, and then it goes out into the regions and it makes a lot of money that way. So that's commercial success. I've not had anything on Broadway right now. So as you can tell by the clothing I'm wearing, you know, and the rags that I'm dragging myself around in, but I'm fairly satisfied, because I have, especially when I make our relationships with people like Russ and Diana at the theater, that people who I like and respect, and they respond and they have insight. So I guess at least I'm hitting on some levels with people here. Whether I make a lot of money, that's in God's hands. It's not mine. Yeah.
Maybe this is a question for off the air, but when a company like Lam or, you know, Joe Blow Theater Company mm-hmm. get your play, if they do a 9 performance run or a 23 performance run, do they pay the same amount?
Mm-mm.
Okay. It's all based on that.
It's based on ticket, you know, like there are different formulas. It depends on the theater. Sometimes it'll be a flat fee per performance, and sometimes it'll be a percentage of the gross. And if they're, so if they're doing 60 performances and they're charging $50 a ticket, I do very well on that. If they're doing six, I do a little, I do less. But that's fair, I think. That way we're all splitting the risk. You know, they make some money, I make some money, and it's, we all do fine.
So you really have risk when these performance companies take up your play, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, although I've been out here doing this for a while, some of my plays don't have high profile, so people might not go, so they might not sell them. So if the show is operating at 100%, then I get a percentage of that. That's great. But if it doesn't have that name recognition, it's like any product. If it doesn't have that thing, then they might be selling 30%, and then I'm making less money because we're sharing that risk.
I got to ask about your acting career.
Mm-hmm.
I know Rudy and the Untouchables.
Okay.
You're probably getting huge royalty checks from those because those are on all the time, right?
Yeah, I get $22 checks, but that was like 1985.
Yeah,
so yeah
but
yeah.
You just did Mindhunters.
I did.
And
yeah, yeah.
We talked about how much you love words and write them down. Mm-hmm. That scene that you were in the episode of Mindhunters had to do with a word or words. It was about words and profiling. You've been out of film acting for a while, and then you get back into it. How's it come about that you're on this Netflix show now for that episode?
Oh, it's weird. I just don't pursue acting anymore. And it really doesn't pursue you unless you're like Robert De Niro, you know. But an agent called me, and I was writing. You know, I mostly write these days, and I'm trying to focus my life there. But an agent called me, an old acting agent, said, "You want to go on this thing?" And I was like, "Well, I got nothing going on this afternoon. You know, I kind of remember how to act. I did it for 30 some years. I remember how that works." So she sent me the script, and I memorized it, and went down, and it felt like it went well. And they called me back for another audition, and it felt like it went well. And I just put it on my mind. And then the agent called and said, "Oh, you got that job." So, okay. So they flew me to Pittsburgh, and I had a lovely weekend in which is a lovely town, by the way. I really like Pittsburgh. And they were very nice to me, and I had a nice scene with Jonathan Groff, the lead of the show. And I got to say lines that were very funny. I think that's why they cast me, because other people were taking it very seriously, and I was looking at these lines like, this is funny. So they need a little lightness in the midst of the darkness of that show.
Yeah, if you've got Netflix, it's season one, episode three, for it.
It's so. Just one scene, but it was a ball.
It's about two-thirds of the way through the show.
Yeah.
If you don't watch Mindhunters, just fast-forward through.
Fast-forward there, exactly.
And get it there. So yeah. Anyway, by the way, 6 degrees of separation from Law & Order, seems like. You did Law & Order's. Everybody's done Law & Order. It's in New York, right?
It's funny. In New York, if you're in a room full of actors, sometimes someone will say, anybody who has not done Law & Order, get out of here. And no one leaves. So I did two SVUs and one Criminal Intent. I never got to do Classic.
Right.
Oh, kills me.
But
there it is.
Well,
what are you going to do?
It's too late now. So.
Yeah.
But you're making people happy other ways.
I'm trying.
So, all right. Well, this play is called Now and Then. It's at Lamb Arts Limited over on Market Street. It runs through this weekend here, this Thursday, September 27th, 28th, and 29th. It's at 7:30. There's a matinee on Sunday at 1:30. The play is written by Sean Grennan, who we've just heard from. It's a fantastically funny and just meaningful play, and as everything that Lamb does, it's just anything they touch is just perfect. So, Sean, been so fun talking to you about
Thank you.
And I hope people get out and enjoy your work.
Thanks so much. I hope so. Go to Lamb's Theater. It's a great theater.
Absolutely it is. I'm a big fan. And we'll be back with more of Good Morning Zooland right here on KSCJ.